Hello and welcome to Minute 48 of the Great Escape Minute, the daily podcast where we dig into the Great Escape 1 minute at a time. I'm Bob.
I'm Tom.
And joining us today on this beautiful Wednesday is Alan Sanders of the Wild Ride and the Marriage Fit podcast. Welcome back, Alan.
Thanks so much for having me back. It's been a lot of fun. So I'm looking forward to being here with you as long as you'll have me back.
Yeah, we'll have to think about that. We'll let you know if we want to have you for the rest of the week or not. We'll see how today goes. All right, so episode 48 starts with Hiltz picking something up from the ground, which looks like a jacket, and it ends with Hiltz explaining what his new blitz will be. So I first want to mention that what's really interesting, I looked at the script, the original script of the film. There's actually a deleted scene that was written that took place in between them finishing the guards going through the hut and showing Hiltz and Ives getting out of prison like we did yesterday. Basically, I'm obviously not going to read it word for word, but what happened is that during the search, they actually found some things in the barracks. They find a cement tray and a cold chisel. Then they have a scene that in Von Luger's office where they have Von Luger speaking with Ramsey about this, and he shows him these items that they found and starts questioning Ramsey as to why they would have these type of things in there. And Ramsey obviously plays dumb and says, I have no idea why they would be there. And so Von Luger says, well, come on, anyone knows what you use this for. The chisel is used to cut through cement, and the tray is in order to cast the false slab in order to cover the tunnel, right? So Ramsey goes, I guess that's possible. And he
could be.
And he also found a pump. And then he says, and what about this? And Ramsey shrugs his shoulders and says, I don't know what this is. You know, an air pump. So then Von Luger gives an order that Strachwitz, that they should start checking every cement floor in the camp. And then Strachwitz leaves. And then Von Luger says to Ramsey, well, I do apologize, but you might be a little uncomfortable for a week or two while we try and sort this out. So he goes, what's a week or two amongst friends, Colonel? Will that be all? And then he dismisses him and he leaves. Von Luger turns to Posen, his right-hand man, and says, well, maybe we found all this if they had a chance to use it. No, sorry, Posen says that to Von Luger. And then Von Luger says, well, that's going to be your job to find out. Now, obviously, this tells us a little more about that. It shows that the Germans are a little smarter than they're portrayed in the movie. But I can completely understand why they cut this out. You know, it doesn't really add anything here to the tone of these scenes to have taken that scene out from the middle.
But that does it does give a hint as to why Ives and Hiltz got out of the cooler early. Because maybe they had to throw whoever's bunks they found the escape tools under into the cooler, and there's only so many cool rooms, and well, let's get rid of the guys who've been in there the longest.
Okay, but that actually makes sense. There is something to that. In the script, it continues, and it's a very short paragraph that discusses Hiltz and Ives leaving. They don't even mention that they just basically show them walking out of the cooler. You know, you don't have the whole point with, Hiltz counting his fingers or anything like that. But what's interesting is that as the two of them are walking away, they both steal things that they see on the side. Hiltz steals a long steel poker used to stoke fire in a big stove. And Ives takes two small tin saucepans and shoves them under his jacket as they walk off. So, I mean, we discussed this a few weeks ago. Obviously, Alan, you weren't here when we discussed it, that the script describes a lot more the way they steal items along the way. You know, Alan, if you remember the scene where Werner catches Henley next to the truck and says, what are you doing? And he says, I'm stealing tools. And he says, stealing tools? Cooler. In the movie, it's played out as a joke because he's not really stealing anything. In the original script, he really is stealing things.
Well, showed that a little bit, and I think it's already a nearly three hour movie. At some point, you just kind of have to fill in
172 minutes.
Right. Almost 3 hours. But you get the sense that they're so used to just picking up as quickly as they can, stashing, grabbing, because you never know what could be either for trading, bartering, or using for escape. And so I did get that sense rewatching the movie much more closely, because I watched everything up to and then beyond the week here that I'm on. And I got that sense already, that they're all, in some ways, there may be one, quote, scrounger, but they were all scavengers at some point.
Yeah, well, as the three of us are all, former soldiers, we know that everyone's a scavenger. Everyone's a scrounger.
Yes, yes.
You know, whose shirt was this? I don't know. I don't care. Does
mine
it
now?
I don't care.
Mine now.
Exactly. So I guess it's the same thing all the way back in during World War II. They did the same things.
Yeah.
It's just since as we said, you know, we were wondering a few days ago about them changing clothes. So I guess that's what they did. They would steal clothes from others, unless you found something else. Remember, you said you would go check to see about the clothes.
I did, and I happened to pull up an article from JMVH.org, a website dedicated to the journals and memories of people who had served. And in this case, it was in World War II, and it happened to be the memories of somebody who was in a prison camp that was dedicated to air personnel that had been shot down and captured by the Germans. So I thought this was probably a journal. And when it comes to clothing, here's exactly what was written in this piece. It said, clothing. As would be expected, our clothes consisted of the items we were wearing when we were shot down. These obviously not last forever. However, Army pattern clothing became available. Ration controlled, possibly obtained through Red Cross sources, but undoubtedly some was material captured by the Germans in various places. We were able to have British boots, shirts, wool underclothing, and later, even some American greatcoats and gloves were available. In addition, individual Red Cross parcels provided things like scarves, gloves, wool hats, and underclothing. There was no regularity about this, and we had to make them last. So, basically, the Germans were getting good supplies, but if they captured enemy supplies, they would just drop it into, like, the camp and let them sort of just, whoever wants whatever, scavenge, it's yours, because we're not going to use it. So that's how they would get it. Or captured parcels from the Red Cross that might make its way back to the camp for just scavenging.
Right. Okay, great. Thanks.
Interesting.
Yeah, that really is. So continuing with this minute. So,
can I say something about this opening hallway? You know how we talked about one of the light sources was coming through the window? The problem is that when you look in this long shot in the hallway, the one suspended light you can see is actually not even lit.
Well, and you see the shadow of the German guards also.
Right. From some other lights somewhere. I'm not sure. It's an interesting thing when you start looking at lighting and set design, but they had the one light purposely hanging in the shot. Further down the hallway, on a wire with a little dome, and it's not even on. At the very least, they could have had a little low bulb lit in there to give you a sense. Well, oh, your sources, they're just hanging intermittently, but the one that I see is not even lit.
Yeah, that's true. They were saving on light bulbs. There was a light bulb shortage.
So the other
thing needed the extra light bulb. They needed the extra light bulb in Hiltz's cell in order to have the
double shadow, yeah. Yeah. He had to have his lights around his vanity for when he got up in the morning and had to comb his hair.
Yeah.
It is interesting. This is what threw me, because I'm like, okay, maybe he got out early for 20 days, but did they both get out early? Because you see his friend here, the tunnel digger himself,
Ives,
you know, he comes out. He's got this look of like, hey, we survived. And okay, but you're both out early. Oh, well, whatever.
But I mean, remember when Ives went into the cell, he had a very dour look on his face, and here he's quite cheery, and he's extremely happy to be out.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that Hiltz takes his jacket with him, but then the big question is, okay, where's his ball and mitt?
Right. Is it buried in the jacket? Because it doesn't look like it.
Right. It doesn't look like it.
I would guess it is tucked into the sleeve of his jacket. That is going to be my guess.
Right. Could be. Okay, so we go to the next scene where we find Mac, Randy, and Roger all in the library. Alan, we've already established that this is the library because of all the reference books on the side, you know, and then the whole slew of Mein Kampfs. you know, one after the other on the side. I don't get tired of that joke.
Well, first I've heard it, and I love it. That's awesome.
Well, I know you, but everyone is listening to this
signed
podcast.
Signed autographed copies.
he doesn't get sick of the My Comp joke. He got sick of the lifeguard joke.
No, because this is my joke. The lifeguard joke is Sedgwick's. That's the difference. So the Mac says no. So the whole conversation here is quite interesting because they're having a conversation about something that you know we catch them in the middle of a conversation. As the minute goes along, you find out what they are talking about because Mac as the head of intelligence able to completely figure out what's going on here. Basically, Hiltz and Ives somehow they found this out, decided to plan to break out.
This is what I don't understand, and I hope you have the script. You could help fill in the gap. How in the hell did they know that these two had conspired in the hole? They were next to each other for 14 days that they had planned. The minute we get out, we're blitzing. We're going to just the two of us. We're friends now. We've had nothing but each other's company for 2 weeks. We're getting out of here the minute they let us out. How in the hell would that have gotten back to, supposedly these guys here in the room to discuss?
Well, Mac is really giving intelligence.
Yeah, that's the line they have to use.
Again, the question is: did they get out of the cooler and walk directly to the library? Did they get out of the cooler and you know the two of them were hanging out on the side, going through their plan a little bit, and someone overheard them? You know, we don't have a tracking shot of them going directly into the library.
No, but in terms
so this could be 2 hours later.
Yeah, so, but in terms of storytelling, editing, you know, unless there's a dramatic shift in light, it's the same kinds of shadows, the same general tone. So as a filmmaker, as I'm watching this and I'm watching how you're cutting it, it feels like they went straight here, almost as if they were told, now that you're out, you need to come see these two guys. They want you.
Right.
So I feel like there's no time that passed. It's just straight from the cooler here to talk to the guys that have been planning this escape while the other two were detained for those 14 days.
Right. Okay. Maybe they bribed one of the guards, but no, if the guards knew about that, that wouldn't work. Right. I don't know. That's a very good question. You know, we're never going to be able to have the answers for everything, especially since we can't ask Sturgis.
And I would argue that they have been summoned here right away because they want to question them about this idea that they're going to blitz. And so it feels like that was the intent.
But maybe they've been summoned an hour. Someone heard it and said, oh, we got to get them here right away. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to it could go either way. Could go either way.
The timeline is questionable. Yeah, it seems like they had time to figure out where someone put their bags and show up to go see the new boss. Is really the impression I've always gotten from that scene is they went into the cooler and hadn't put their bags down, and now they got to find them and go see the boss. But yeah, there's no time for, even if they're discussing it, for someone to then tell Mac, for Mac to then be sitting with Ramsey and Big X, for them to be having the conversation, to summon them to, yeah, the timeline is incredibly questionable.
And by the way, right. I'm not bringing this up because I want to try to find holes with the movie. I mean, it's unfortunately what we do when we slow a movie down. When you're watching it real time, it just feels okay. You know, you're assuming they want to meet the guy that they didn't get a chance to sit down and talk because the day they arrived, within minutes, he got himself thrown in the cooler. So, you know, it does kind of make sense he'd be summoned, but just the fact that they're going to throw in there, ooh, our intel guy is just so good. He already knew what you were planning. Well, there's no way possible.
Or just a giant bluff on Ramsey's part. He knows Hiltz has done 18-plus. He's done 18-plus attempts. He's been in the hole for 2 weeks. He's probably come up with something. I'm going to let him, you know, because they don't seem to know him. So we're going to let him think the X-Organization is even more impressive than it already is, and that, yes, we knew what you two were talking about while you were in the hole. Come clean now.
Mm. Okay, that one I think is kind of is a little more plausible. Although I thought the question was, "What are you planning to do?" or something. How do, I can't remember who asks it first.
Yeah, they ask it in a second. They say they ask the questions about the Blitzer.
Okay, yeah. So they know about it ahead of time.
They're maybe not- maybe they know that they're planning something. They don't know what yet.
Okay. I can drop that line of questioning because I have another question. And this is, again, for you guys. You're the experts. Why at the time, at this point in the storytelling, knowing here's an American who has had a reputation for having 17 other escapes, he's been recaptured, obviously, or at least attempts plus escapes. Why do you not bring him into your plan right now? Why don't you say, well, hold on a second. Here's what we've been working on. Why not now?
He's not part of the X organization.
But he's in the camp, and at some point you're gonna have to assume
he's in the camp. He's in the camp, but for 14 days they've already been planning everything. Right. They don't have a spot for him in the X organization. They don't have a top level spot. You know, he's not gonna get an executive position. They're gonna give him something in the mailroom which he's not gonna.
No key to the washroom. You were a
no, bad. but you can actually think about it from that perspective too. That here you have a high-ranking American officer, and obviously the way that the whole script is planned out, he doesn't need to be in the organization. But it's not as if someone said at the beginning, "Oh, Hiltz is an expert at getting caught, so let's put him." Let's give him this position. He'll be out in 2.5 weeks. You know, he'll be out in 3 weeks.
Now I'm going to jump in what I think is really going on here. I think these are those moments that Steve McQueen put pressure on the film and the producers to give him more lines and more scenes. This is really a nonsense scene. It's just really here to give Steve McQueen something to do.
It's very possible.
Yep.
I mean, this is before he became as popular as he became afterwards. This movie helped propel him to that position, but it is a known fact that he caused a little bit of
He was able to get the whole production to pause and have someone go rewrite the script. Yeah. Like they were already ramping up; they were well into pre-production, and he's like, "Well, I'd love to be part of it. If you're going to do that, you're going to have to boot. My character needs to do more."
Right.
Obviously, how much do you guys, and you can choose to take this out, but like, you know, the whole motorcycle thing? I mean, that was never part of reality. That was just
Steve McQueen. No, of course not. That's completely Steve McQueen.
Yeah. There's nothing about that. He actually said, "I want to write a scene in where I'm riding a motorcycle." I think it makes sense.
There was no motorcycle there. And he's like, "Well, I still want it." And
There will be now. Did it.
which again comes out as one of the most iconic moments of the film or of movies in general. So, you know, it means that Steve McQueen knew what he was doing.
Well, yeah, I'm the star. Whether you know what? I think you've got to have at some level. Let's face it, you're an actor. People are paying money to look at you. At some point, you need to have that kind of an ego that says, "I'm worth looking at." And so, if you feel like my part's not good enough to be looked at, you feel weird about that. And so, as an actor, and it's really hard to stop that ego from becoming egomaniacal. But you know, I can see where he's like, "Look, look. You've got me. You're going to have to work with me, okay?"
Right. I mean, again, this isn't Towering Inferno. We haven't reached that level yet. You know, I'm assuming you're familiar with the fact that in his contract it said that he and Paul Newman have to have exactly the same number of words, you know, in the script.
Yeah, wasn't that, and this is one of those little side stories, wasn't it true that because of the two actors that the posters, there were an equal number of posters printed? One with one name just a little bit higher than the other, and then the first.
Yeah. But in addition to that, the contract said that they both had to have the exact same number of words to say in the script and the same number of minutes on screen or something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go.
Steve McQueen did get the last laugh.
There are many actors these days that would be able to get away with that.
No. I was going to say, Steve McQueen did get the last laugh, though, on the IMDb. Steve McQueen is above Paul Newman for Towering Inferno. The
cast. He's also the first billed here for IMDb movie as well. He's top bill.
Yeah.
Correct. So basically one of the things that Max says is that I'm afraid that we're going to wake up the sleeping goons, which takes us back to Roger's line where he basically said that we're going to bore them to death and put the goons to sleep. So it's interesting that they're still using the same phrasing between, you know, It's been a few weeks, and they're still using the same phrasing of what they want to.
To me, it's derogatory. You know, these Germans are just a bunch of goons. They're not real soldiers. They're not. Like, we're going to use denigrating terminology for them.
All right. Again, I'm gonna. I said this 2 days ago. I'm holding up for later in the week. I got what to say about the word goons. Also, it's going to be interesting. Come back and listen all week, everyone.
Look at you. You're dropping teases for episodes that won't come for another couple days. You dropped this on Monday.
That's why not, skill, man? No, because I wanted to be more relevant.
Mm-hmm. No, it makes sense. Hey, I will tell you, there's this little interaction between Richard Attenborough, which will eventually be Sir Richard Attenborough, and Steve McQueen, where they're actually interacting with one another. And I did find this little tidbit out that it was kind of interesting that Richard Attenborough found Steve McQueen difficult to work with on set.
What a surprise.
Yeah.
I don't believe it.
I can't understand. I don't understand why. Yeah. It is interesting that it took 48 minutes to put the two top billed stars in the film together. And don't forget, Hiltz hasn't met Henley yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. According to what I read, he said, and this was years later, it may have even been after Steve McQueen had passed away, but he said it was years later, it was one of the toughest challenges he ever faced, and their on-set relationship was, quote, not peaceful.
Hmm. Here's a trivia that Tom and I have discussed already. Richard Attenborough wasn't originally supposed to play this part. Who originally was supposed to play the part?
I know. It was going to be Dumbledore.
Yes. Very good.
Richard Harris.
That's great. That's
he
right.
got caught on a film that he was working on that, wasn't it, he was like, the film ran over time or something, but he wasn't going to be able to wrap his role up or something.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. I bet he kicked himself for years on that one.
Well, you know, Richard Harris has had a pretty good career himself before he passed away.
That's true, but you know, this is a top spot too.
You know, I love, obviously Richard Attenborough is a very good actor and became a very good director, but when I see him, I almost feel like the character, the mythos that they create around Roger. And then you've got sort of this like Pillsbury Doughboy looking character. He's a very good actor, but he just doesn't have that look to me of somebody who would be trusted to lead this, you know, group X, this whole, we're here to create as much havoc and problem. He just looks like, I don't know, like the chubby kid that would have gotten picked on.
He doesn't have the lines, but he has the, I'm sorry, he doesn't have the look, but he has the lines. Because you see in the scene a few weeks ago when he starts laying out the plan, you see that he's the Attenborough's acting. You can see that the wheels in his brains are moving as he's planning out and stuff like that. So I guess you can say he's might not be the brawn, and he might not be he might not have the body, but he's the one with the brains.
Right. Roger's playing chess, the Germans are playing checkers.
Exactly.
And in terms of talent, the actor pulls that part off. It's just, it's still visually, and unfortunately when you watch a movie, sometimes you have to look and go, can you believe the character has well-written lines and very well delivered? There's always that point where I look at him and go, ugh, I just wish he had had just maybe a little bit more of that, I don't know, I don't want to call it manliness, but a little bit more of that sort of chiseled jaw leader type versus kind of the doughboy that, you know, has had a couple too many crumpets.
Right. But at this point, that almost makes
sense. How long has he been captured? Remember, he spent 3 months with the Gestapo. So the Gestapo probably has pretty good food for their prisoners, too.
No, he's well fed. He didn't skip any meals.
Well, and I was going to say, though, that him almost being him looking unassuming, I almost feel like makes him better. And I feel like in, you know, modern Hollywood, we're trained for George Clooney and Brad Pitt are the ones running the groups versus, you know, but in reality, George Clooney or Brad Pitt stick out like a sore thumb in any group. You know, Richard Attenborough at this point, I mean, you put him in a crowded room, but he's not going to stand out other than the fact he's, well, Richard Attenborough and people recognize him from it. But if you don't know who he is, you're not going to necessarily see him and go, he's somebody.
Right, that's true. I think there is something to that, because when he was brought into camp, the first thing that some of the other prisoners say is they don't know who he is, meaning that the Germans weren't able to figure out that he's Big X. So I think that's a very good point. If it was George Clooney, they would have known. So we continue along with the minute, and Ramsay at that point confronts them and says, "So I understand that you two are attempting a blitz out."
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes, "Where'd you hear that, sir?" Which is really fun to hear him to actually answer that. And then they start explaining a little bit more about that. Oh, Mac's in charge of knowing everything that goes on here. Apparently, it's his job to even know what's going on in the cooler and to hear whispers of how they're going to try to get out. And then it's interesting the way that Roger basically tries to deal with it diplomatically and says, maybe we should discuss this. Maybe you want to talk it over.
This is, and I'm going to come at it from watching the actor, and again, I can't help but know the backstory of Steve McQueen wanting it to be all about him. But it seems like he is just so uninterested in being in a military mode when he's delivering these lines. He's got his hands in his back pocket. He's kind of hunched forward. He almost is like, "You guys are wasting my time. Why am I talking to you?" It feels weird. It feels like he doesn't have any kind of military decorum, where the other three guys, they were very much sort of, and maybe it's the British, but that regiment, just goofy.
That's what this is. This is another way of Sturgis showing the discrepancies between the Americans and Brits are. Brits are formal and everything. Americans are informal. Come on. What type of look at Hiltz's uniform. He's wearing a sweater, you know. A short sleeve sweater. It's cut. It's a long sleeve sweater I'm surprised that he actually cut it at the elbows, as opposed to like cutting it at the shoulders, you know, giving the really rough James Dean look.
Well, it's weird acting choices, even if you're trying to call him out because he's not wearing a uniform. The hunched forward, almost like, can I go now? Like, if it was redone today, this is like the Keanu Reeves, like, "Whoa, dude. Okay. I'm going tonight. Okay. Like, okay. All right. Thanks." It just feels so out of, it just feels weird. I mean, it's okay. I like his character because he sort of is a I don't care kind of a character. At least when we first meet him, he's going to take care of himself. He's already sizing things up, but it stands out to me when I watch this three-person scene turn into a four, or actually a five-person season technically when they come in. It's just really interesting acting choices that the director let through.
Right. That there's no question about that. And what Ramsay's next line is what really gets me. He says, "Everybody in the camp is supposed to clear all escape attempts in advance." Hello? Wasn't Hiltz already there? You know, he's been in other camps. He must know that there is protocol here, you know, that things are done in a certain way. That's what gets me here. You know, obviously he's not part of the X organization. Maybe again, that's the difference between maybe the X organization was just a British thing, or that's what they're showing here, that it was a British thing, because, you know, they let Henley in, you know, into their club. The formality of it is that if you want to escape, you got to get permission to do so. Letting just anyone try to some attempts, you know, and it seems that there's definitely a lot of, you know, everyone is following those orders, except for Hiltz.
Well, here's right. What I think it is. MC's the senior British officer. Hiltz is the senior American officer. And I mean, just in terms of how officer, the British and the American military have fairly similar rank structures in terms of like 01, 02, 03, 04 stuff, and there's a discrepancy between Ramsay and Hiltz. But I would think Hiltz is going, "Yeah, great, you can have all your little British flags come ask you for permission to leave. I'm an American. If I want to leave, I'm going to go ahead and take my own permission to do that." You know, or what's his name? The other one. I can't. If Goff wants to leave, he'll come ask Hiltz's permission to go to make an escape, but he might not go to Ramsay. You know, so maybe in previous camps, there was a Army Air Corps colonel there that Hiltz would have a little more respect in dealing.
But it's possible. I mean, there is a big discrepancy between their ranks, though. Even though they're in different military, you know, different countries, Ramsay's a group captain. He's in OF5. Hiltz is only in OF2. So it's not as if he's close in rank to him.
Right.
Right.
So he still has the respect, you know, as they say, you respect the rank, not the man.
Well, right. And I think that's, I don't know if it's done well or if I'm trying to read too much into it, but I think that's the, I'm giving you this courtesy because you are the senior British officer. I'm telling you what I'm going to do. I'm not going to, if you don't know, that's great. And I might listen to you telling you us no, but I'm going to do my own thing and deal with it. You know,
well, that's that the one hole in this whole thing is Ives, which we won't know until tomorrow. They must know this because they just have this mental telepathy and were able to figure out that the two of them had already concocted this plan. Ives is planning to go too, and he wasn't asking for permission either.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
And Ives actually does need to get permission. he's aware of the, I mean, we know that he's good friends with McDonald, because Mac is the one who claps him on the back after he, you know, blows the raspberry that he was sent away for 14 days.
For 14 days.
14 days.
It seems like 20, but it's actually only 14.
That's right. That's right.
Oh, well, it's daylight saving time.
Exactly. I was going to say there's different regions, you know, in the time zones.
Different keep time differently. That's just, it's all messed up.
Yeah, exactly. At this point, then they ask him, okay, what's your plan? So he says, well, you know, we're going to sneak out at night through a blind spot that I found in the wire. Now, didn't they establish a few weeks ago, for us it was a few weeks, that it's not really a blind spot because they started shooting at him?
Yeah, that was the most, if you want to go back from the very beginning and again, watch the whole movie, I was like, I thought you said it's a blind spot and you can see their faces looking right at you. There's no way that that's a blind spot. Once again,
it's because it's below them, so they can't see it. Whatever. That's what they're trying to explain.
I get it, but then not one single camera angle gave us that it was believable because we kept seeing the guards' faces in their towers. Had they had an angle where all of a sudden you realize, okay, the guard, unless he's leaning over, kept seeing their faces, and that's what bothered me the whole time. So anyway, it is what it is.
Didn't we decide, though, Rob, that that's a blind spot at night because of where the searchlights were positioned? The lights didn't have the range to hit the middle, and that's why it's a blind spot. In day, the guards can see it because the sun's out.
That makes sense, but then why the hell would Hiltz throw the ball during the day?
Right.
He's going to lose his baseball. He's going to lose his baseball. Do either of you have anything else for this minute?
No,
I'm good.
All right, I got one more thing. At the beginning of this scene, when you have Mac Ramsey and Roger speaking, Mac uses the phrase that up the creek without a paddle. Now, that hit me really strange. I was thinking, wait a second, in World War II they used that phrase? For me it sounds even more modern than the 1960s. Obviously, it was used in 1963, because it was used in the script. Do either of you have any idea how far back that phrase goes?
I thought it was an old phrase. For some reason, again, it's like back in like the Royal Navy, you know, Revolutionary time.
You would be correct. You're right. So I looked it up. I got it from Wiktionary, which that's what it's called.
Yeah.
Wiktionary. And it's basically, yeah, I'm going to read this one word for word. Sorry to bore everyone listening to this, but you know, and we'll bleep out the few curse words that are mentioned in here. So I found it really fascinating learning the origin of the phrase up the creek. This phrase may have come from Hasler Creek in Portsmouth Harbor, a salt creek, maybe the origin of the ultra of up a creek. Wounded soldiers during Nelson's time. Okay, so Admiral Nelson was I think, around the turn of the 19th century, if I remember correctly. So we're talking at least, you know, the late 1700s, early 1800s. Okay, so wounded sailors during Nelson's time were taken there to be admitted to the Royal Navy Hospital, to die or to recover. The ships moored up in the Solent, and the wounded soldiers were transported up the creek by tramline, hence the phrase up the creek without a paddle.
Because you have to pull your boat up the creek. Right.
That's right. They were held prisoner so that they would not desert while being treated, and some tried to escape by going through the sewers to the creek. Another reason why they have the alternative phrase up the creek. Without a paddle, this would be hopeless. Hence the phrase, up the creek without a paddle, to mean trapped, stuck, or in trouble. Much very obscure Navy jargon entered popular culture in the seafaring peoples of the British Isles and thus entered the English language as a whole.
Wow. Okay, good.
I just found that really interesting. Sorry if I bored people with that.
I love the etymology of words and phrases. I think sometimes that to me is fascinating to just take a second and go, okay, well, where does that phrase actually come from? And a lot of times people go, I don't know, I just know what it means, you know?
Exactly. Again, if either of you have anything else to say about this minute?
Nope.
All right. Alan, why don't you once again tell everyone how they can get in touch with you?
All right. I'll do a different podcast today because I do two specifically, but the one that my wife and I started this year, we thought it was kind of interesting as we became first-time empty nesters, unless they come back. We created a podcast called the Marriage Fit Podcast. My wife is a personal trainer, so she's into fitness. And, of course, we are a blended family, having both been divorced and remarried to each other. So we were learning how to get our pieces to fit together. And, of course, like any good family, you tend to throw a fit from time to time. So we thought that was a clever way to call it a marriage-based and relationship-based podcast. We call it the Marriage Fit Podcast with just giving some of our thoughts and advice. We're not relationship experts. We're certainly not counselors, and we don't have – going to send you to a church or something like a lot of relationship podcasts. It's just real stories from what we've learned, and sometimes we learn the hard way if we can prevent you from making the same mistakes. And sometimes we've just learned how to be better communicators as a result, and if we can help people, that'd be awesome. So it's called the Marriage Podcast. Every podcatcher of your choice, that's what it's called. You got to use all four words, The Marriage Fit Podcast. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, the website, themarriagefitpodcast.com.
All right, great. And while you're checking that out, why don't you go rate, review, and subscribe for the show. Give us nice ratings, hopefully. You can get in touch with us via our website, thegreatescapeminute.com. You can shoot us a tweet on Twitter at greatescapemm. Our email is thegreatminute@gmail.com, and you can come and chat with us at Facebook group, The Cooler. So until tomorrow, tally-ho.
Tally-ho.
Tally-ho.